David Jaffe is the Associate Dean of Student Affairs at American University's Washington College of Law, one of the largest law schools in the country. David is a pioneer who was on the cutting edge of the dialogue surrounding the connection between wellness and true success in the law. David shares his vision for sparking innovative conversations and designing unique coursework in law schools, which will produce lawyers with a growth mindset as they blaze new trails within the profession. Our discussion is a realistic journey through the challenges facing the profession as we continue to uncover the oft-ignored connection between wellness and winning. Enjoy this episode of Iron Advocate as we continue to explore how lawyers can kill it in the practice of law without it killing us.
You're listening to Iron Advocate, the podcast dedicated to you, the trial attorney, sage, visionary, warrior, unfiltered, no holds barred, Iron Advocate. Join Bob Levant, Jeff Riebel, and today's top legal minds on a journey to discover how to kill it in the law without it killing you. Because being the best advocate for others begins with being the best advocate for yourself.
Thanks a lot for being here, David.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me today.
So people in firms see wellness kind of like a smiley face magnet on the refrigerator. Many of them might see addiction, depression, divorce, even suicide as the cost of doing business. How can the lawyer well-being movement, in which you are a really strong voice, get through this long-standing force field kind of ingrained culture and continue to make progress?
That's a great opening question, and it's a big one, but probably a great place to start. We're seeing gradual changes. We're seeing some chinks in the armor, but quite honestly, we're not going to have wholesale movement until law firms see these issues as important as their bottom line, until they see that the revenue stream, if that's what's driving a law firm, is going to be positively affected by their lawyers being healthier. Until we get the issues of stigma out of the way, which is not law firm specific or germane, but is one of the significant issues out there. This is a conversation. Mental health is a disease like any other, and it's an illness like any other. And if we're going to support our attorneys and our law students when they're dealing with cancer or dealing with diabetes or dealing with something else, then there's no reason that we shouldn't be dealing with mental health issues at the exact same level. And once we recognize that across the board and begin to address it across the board, we're going to all be better for it.
David, how can you get law firms, and especially let's say the largest law firms, to understand that this is a bottom line issue? What's been successful?
Well, what I've heard, so to be fair, my feet are probably are more ensconced in the law school environment, but what I've heard from colleagues and when I've spoken with attorneys and friends, obviously having graduated myself or at the law firms, the bottom line is the big one. Oftentimes that will relate to turnover or retention. There are obviously significant resources that have to be put in every time an attorney decides to leave for a more comfortable environment. So that is significant. It also has an effect on certainly a team if they're working on a project or individual attorneys who have to pick up the work in the absence in that regard. But there's also, you know, the basic kind of morale component as well. If folks are not feeling well and comfortable in a firm, that permeates. And it's not just the attorneys, but it's the staff. It's the folks who are working diligently to support them who are also being affected. And it just does not make for a positive environment. Further to that, you know, the kind of spider web effect, if an attorney is not being supported and is not feeling well, he or she is taking that home. It's affecting their family situation, which is then going to double back on the work effort that they're able to put in or not able to put in. And that just continues to build upon itself. And so the firms, again, need to have their eyes open, need to have this fully a part of the partner committee meetings or whatever meetings that they're having. In theory or in practice, wellness committees ought to be set that are being taken seriously so that concerns can be raised within the firm and that the general counsel, whoever is helping to supervise, can help to manage that. You should have opportunities for anonymous or confidential reporting because there are concerns typically more so perhaps for junior attorneys or those who are on, you know, partner track who may not be comfortable sharing some of the environmental issues that are taking place, but you have to have that door open or nothing's going to change.
David, you mentioned mental health issues, and I know that that's a pervasive and often overlooked issue. And my question for you is around addiction and other things. It seems that lawyers are more willing to admit they have, let's say, an alcohol problem than admit that they're emotionally or overwhelmed or somehow mentally or psychologically struggling. Have you found or seen ways that you can help lawyers and law students who you're more familiar with come forward around their emotional and psychological struggles?
It's a great question, Jeff. And I would, to be candid, I don't know if this will be a direct answer, but I'm going to think aloud a little bit, and I invite your input and Bob's as well in this regard. In the law school setting, what I have found to be very interesting, we've had at our law school, at the Washington College of Law, we've had a satellite counselor, meaning somebody who's hired from the main campus counseling center, but is working exclusively with law students. And although we are screened from having any individual information about a student without their consent or permission, I am able to get aggregate information. And what I've heard, and I think this probably would spill forward as well, the issues in the law school setting, by and large, are not law school grounded. And what I mean by that, I mean, to be fair, students have concerns around tuition. They have concerns around where their future employment's going to be. They have concerns around grades and things like that. But by and large, when they're meeting with our counselors, the issues that are expressed, that they're bringing forward, that they're sharing and trying to resolve, are typically issues that have to do with situations that occurred prior to law school, family situations, relationship situations, maybe trauma from when they were younger, that have not quite been addressed. And the sense is that this may be coming out for the first time because they're, you know, college was kind of a chance to be free and not necessarily doing as much self-care, but just kind of being away from home and maybe experimenting and kind of living that life. And now it's this pivot in law school where things need to be taken seriously. This is for most, except for very few students, this is going to be the terminal degree prior to practice. And so a lot of these issues seem to bubble forth really for the first time. And, you know, as you mentioned, Jeff, the issues around mental health, because the stigma is still there, not that it's not around alcohol as well, but there's a greater understanding that there are, you know, prevalent issues around alcohol. And so that seems to be more acceptable, kind of in quotes, to some degree, where mental health is still, there's this presumption that it's the individual's fault, that there's something that he or she should have control over. And this typically, even more so in the legal profession, the environment where you will have a number of, you know, type A individuals who feel that they should be able to be on top of everything. They should not need assistance. And so the issues that haven't been addressed are just, they just pop up. And again, you know, this is going to be the common theme. The way to be able to address them is to say, this is normal, is to normalize it to a degree and then provide the resources without judgment, without any repercussions from it, to be able to address them.
So, David, a lot there to unpack.
Yeah.
Let me start with this. It's not even a premise. I think it's a fact. The law is a very isolating profession. Law school is isolating. The law is isolating.
Right.
So what I hear you saying is that law school and the nature of the law exacerbates what we all have. I mean, everybody has suffering and we all have wounds. And when we find ourselves in law school, those wounds are probably infected even more so than in many other professions. That's my personal take as somebody who fits that mold. How do we, so I'm a trial lawyer, as you know,
right?
And confronting the isolation and the fear and vulnerability has made me a far better trial lawyer on the back end of my career than I, or at least this end of it, I hope there's still more ends of it, than I was at the front end. How do we convince lawyers, and particularly law students from where you're sitting, that embracing the things that you just talked about actually will unlock the greatest version of an advocate that they have within them?
Yep. Again, a very good question. And I have what I believe is a fairly simple answer. I think the more that peers come out, and so really depending on the environment, if you're talking about the law firm setting, it's colleagues. In the law school, you're talking about classmates, right? I've been dean of students for 25 years. It took me a good number of those years to develop a thick enough skin to appreciate that I care about my students. I'm passionate about what they're going through. I want to work with any student who's having an issue, but oftentimes I'm going to be seen as an administrator, somebody who is either holding judgment or in the perception of some students' eyes is going to have an obligation to report out, let's say, to character and fitness or to other bodies. And so I may not be the go-to individual. But classmates, particularly classmates who may be in recovery and are comfortable as part of the recovery and working with students, have this absolute gift and power to be able to speak to students until they perhaps can find the trust and be able to speak with me and know that I have the resources and desire to help them to be able to get those students in that direction. I think in the law firm analogy, and again, maybe even more difficulty because of the attorney, the makeup, the kind of the DNA of the attorneys that we already referenced, I think it's an extremely bold and brave individual who's willing to say, I'm in recovery. I can help colleagues of mine who are going through it. I can speak at a firm meeting. I'm happy to do so because I'm confident in where I am, and I know that I can help other individuals. And again, it's a fairly simplistic response to your question, Jeff, but it really can be, it's really profound because now you're looking at somebody who's saying, she's where I need to be, but she's working, you know, again, as a student, and she's effective as a student, or she's working, you know, by my side or in my law firm, and I can see that she is succeeding. And I know that if she was where she is, where I want to be, that I can get there. And so I think those peer-to-peer contacts, and again, can be difficult. Handful of years ago, I couldn't even offer that at my school because I didn't have students who were coming to me. And I've been blessed the last couple of years where I've had a couple of students each year following orientation where I've expressed my desires to support our students around these areas of substance use and mental health. I've had students come to me and say, we heard from upper level classmates that you believe in this, that you support it. I'm somebody in recovery. I want to make myself available to my classmates. And it's a godsend, quite frankly. And I think, again, the more we can get that message out of the power and that happening, the better off we're all going to be.
And if I could echo that, David, but also say this, that obviously the recovery is critically important and the recognition that it's okay to step forward. But there's also the underlying, you know, wounds, as you said, that lead to, you know, the addictions, the severe depressions. And I think that it's also some of the wellness practices that include, you know, regular therapy, which is really out there for almost anybody if you look for it, budget or not. There are a lot of outlets for that. You know, coaching, mentoring, and anybody who listens to Iron Advocate knows Jeff and I, you know, openly talk about our use of therapists, which has been critically important to my success as a trial lawyer and my wellness practice. So I think it runs throughout all lawyers because, again, you know, being a lawyer pushes you toward this idea of having the answers, being strong, never admitting fear, this idea that if clients or other lawyers hear you, you know, question yourself in any way, that's a weakness they don't want to see. That leads to all the things we're talking about. Right. And with that backdrop, let me ask you this. If you were granted an unlimited budget, no curriculum restrictions, and asked to create a new law school, what would the title of a course or two be aimed at creating the personally and professionally strongest advocates that you could?
Sure. I've thought about that many, many times, and I may butcher the titles, but I think one of the two courses that I'd have in mind would be Mindfulness in the Law. And the second one would be a course on professional identity formation. They're both self-seeking and self-learning at the end of the day. The mindfulness, and I'm sure most of your listeners will be aware of it, but just the ability to be in the moment with oneself, to kind of tune some other things out and, you know, practice some breathing and just kind of bringing oneself back to center and being okay in the moment, which just has the incredible ability to clear the mind and allow one to go forward. The professional identity and professional identity formation is more about self. Who is it? What are the skill sets that I have that are going to allow me to engage and be a productive individual in the world? What are the skill sets that I may be lacking that I can find some time and ability and maturity to learn? And what are some of the challenges that I might have that maybe from my upbringing, maybe skill sets that I just, you know, I didn't learn well, could have been parenting, could have been other things, could have been trauma that affected me in my way. What can I do in those areas to improve myself? And the courses do exist. We need to do a better job at seeing them expand so that every law school is considering them. And I would say by extension, and it's something that's very dear to me, and actually some current recent conversations that have been held about, we also need in the law school setting to be ensuring that our students are receiving, perhaps in addition to these courses, but are receiving a minimum education, a minimum dose of understanding around substance use and mental health, what they mean and where to go for resources. And it's actually something that I've been pushing with the ABA to see us have as an amendment to their standards so that as part of a law school to be reaccredited, that they would have to sustain that as a learning outcome of their graduates, of their students, that they would have been steeped in this education. So couple of components, at least in a law school setting, that I think would help in that regard, Bob.
David, what you're saying really resonates with me, something Bob and I talk about, you know, all the time, almost every day. And the question I have around that is, how do we deliver these services, this information to law students when we know the law students and lawyers are hurting? We know this, and Bob and I talk about, you know, our own pain. And it seems like there's a huge amount of shame and vulnerability, particularly around mental and emotional health issues, which underlie a lot of the addiction problems that you've talked about. The addiction just as sort of the above the waterline piece. Right. How do you package this in a way so that law students won't shy away from a class like that and they'll say, oh, that's for somebody else, I don't want to look at my vulnerabilities? But how do you package it or sell it to people in a way so they can actually realize this is going to make them a better advocate, stronger at what they do? They're going to win more, because we all know how competitive law students are, at least I was, and I know Bob was. How do we package that better to them?
Yeah, I mean, it's another good question. It takes time. It really takes time. We've been pushing for one of the courses to be added where I work. And again, I know a number of law schools that are doing it. And oftentimes the early concern is, well, aren't you going to end up preaching to the choir? The students who already get it are the ones who are going to gravitate towards it. And that may be true, but I also, and we've seen examples that, I mean, the happiness course at Yale is a great kind of one-off, but similar example, which is it's been oversubscribed every year. You can't get into it. You put it out there and it starts to tentacle out. I mean, word gets out from a successful press professor teaching a successful course that it really made a difference in the lives of the students. And you gather student testimonials and you have them talk about it. You may, in some instances, although most law schools have quality faculty, but sometimes students resonate even better with an outside individual. And so you might invite somebody in to teach a course like that as an adjunct who is already steeped in the area as part of their profession. And that brings some added cachet and intrigue to the students who are looking to do it. You could even bring back alumni. And oftentimes alumni can also have that resonance, you know, if they're steeped in the area, because they can appreciate and the students can appreciate, again, I am in a position as a student, and I'm looking ahead and I'm seeing that you are in the type of position that I'd like to be in. So you can find some teasers and ways, if you will, that can make it more attractive, but it does take time. You have to build a course, you have to have it, it has to be successful. You have to assess it and make sure it's been successful. And I think it will, you know, it's some version of if you build it, it will come. And I think it just continues to grow and strengthen over time.
So I can tell you my experience with some of these classes and the way I hear mindfulness talked about. And I've been practicing meditation for a while, and I'm trained to teach meditation to lawyers. I find it to be just lacking. You know, as I said to Bob, I like my wellness with a shot of bourbon. And I oftentimes feel like there's not enough oomph behind, not enough push, not enough. If somebody's inviting me to explore my own vulnerability, there's got to be some reason other than just, because I have to, if I'm going to admit this to myself and I'm a lawyer and all I care about is sort of winning, there has to be something deeper. And so I guess this is a comment, but a question for you. Is this something you think the folks in the, what I'll call the wellness movement in the law, are starting to connect these dots so that they see they're not going to get to people just by saying, hey, we need these problems addressed, but they show folks something that's actually going to make them, you know, better advocates?
I don't know. It's a great observation, Jeff. And I honestly don't know the answer to it. What I do know, and maybe this isn't the best way to approach it, but the hand-wringing that follows the suicide that occurs at a law firm, where you have partners and associates and others looking around and saying either we should have seen the signs or we need to do something better, is not what any law firm ought to be waiting for. And we've had enough examples, both with law firms that have had a willingness to express what it has felt like to go through that, and indeed have come out as a better firm afterwards, together with what I imagine are still law firms where that information is hidden to the extent that it can be, out of fear that, you know, clients are going to go running, that this is a law firm that's unique and has some particular problem, when we know that it's across the board. In terms of, you know, how to continue to push the movement, it's the thread that we've been discussing during this podcast, and I know that the two of you have had in others, which is it is only a good and positive investment. You know, we each have one life to live at the end of the day, and we want to be or ought to be as healthy as we can be. And so whether it's the, you know, bottom line production for a law firm or just any individual saying, I know I'm going to feel better if I can work through these issues, it's all the same positive result at the end of the day. But as to whether we're hitting on all cylinders yet and we still have work to do, there's clearly work to be done in that regard, Jeff.
And David, your candor about both the issues we confront and also some of the unanswered questions about the hows. I want to, you know, kind of continue digging where Jeff was, which is that, you know, my/our vantage point, I think, at Iron Advocate is that Jeff sort of hit the nail on the head, which is that at the end of the day, many of the firms out there, you know, they have to connect value and the bottom line to the resources they expend, whether it be toward wellness or anything else. Right. And there's also a culture from law school up that, like, well, this just isn't, it's not my time to be healthy. You know, like I'm a grinder, you know, I'm learning to be a lawyer. You know, this is, you know, kind of this is the lifestyle. Now the truth is without question that you are a better lawyer and advocate when you exercise these practices and these other muscles, you know, mindfulness, mind body practice, meditation, et cetera. But again, how do we, I want to ask specifically about the law students, how do we, and you started to touch upon maybe, you know, bringing outside people in, because a lot of it has to do with the next generation, right? We can make some progress at the firms, but if we start training lawyers and sending them into the firms and they ultimately become the partners with a different view, we're going to, quote, win the battle. Right. So on that beachhead, how do you get through to that law student? to explain to them, and I will make it personal, that, you know, your closing argument, okay, in this scenario will be better if, you know, with a case that you already know upside down and inside out, you find time the night before that closing to do yoga, to meditate. I promise you, from personal experience, that your presentation will be better, and you'll manage the anxiety better. The anxiety is going to be there. You have to embrace it. So how do we convince these law students that, quite frankly, these practices of mindness and wellness will help them win?
I think through everything we have discussed, I think it is going to continue to grow over time. I mean, some of this is top down. You need to, at any individual law school, you have to have a dean who's committed to these issues. You have to have faculty who are willing to reinforce it in classes. They may do, you know, could do a short stretching exercise at the beginning of class. They can do very brief breathing exercises. I know a number of our faculty do this here at our law school and others as well. And you need to fold it into the conversation. It does go back to the, you know, professional identity, professional formation. It does go back to instilling in students that, as you suggested, Bob, it's only going to serve them well. And then, as you also pointed out, it is generational to a degree. As these students come through school, hearing these messages and believing them, they are in the opportunity to start asking these questions when they're interviewing at law firms. And a number of the students, particularly successful ones who have opportunities, multiple opportunities to interview, it is an excellent, excellent space for them during an interview to be able to ask around work balance, what is a law firm doing around well-being? And so that the more that crescendo, you know, starts to rise and is heard, the law firms are moving from, or will move from, gee, you know, that candidate, maybe we shouldn't be following up with him because he's asking questions around well-being. Is there something there? To hearing this chorus of every candidate asking for the same thing and saying, I think we need to look inward. I think the law firm is not, you know, we're not doing what we need to be. I remember I had the honor about a year or so ago of serving on it was an afternoon of ABA roundtables. Senior partners from law firms had come together for a conference of a different type, but the president had challenged us to take a couple of hours aside and talk about some of these issues. And there was a partner at our table and said, look, we're developing well-being at our law firm. And let me give you an example of what happened. I've got a couple of associates on a team on a project that I'm working on. And we were having a happy hour in this week. And so on the Tuesday of the week, I said, you're all coming to the happy hour, right? And they said, yeah, we're coming. And I went to the happy hour that night and one of the associates showed up but the other one didn't. And I emailed him the next day and said, you said you were going to come. What happened? And the associate wrote back, I forgot my daughter had a soccer game, so I went to the soccer game with her. And the partner looked at me across the table and said, and there you go. And the there you go was, we did everything we could as a law firm, and this associate just decided to go off and spend time with their family. And I had to do everything I could in my power to just kind of, you know, just resist what I wanted to say, and instead said somewhat diplomatically, well, that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it was, you know, part of being with family is the balance that we're all looking for. And so some of that, and I don't mean to, you know, that to castigate for that to be across the board, but some of this, we need to move from the notion that, you know, this professional hazing, you know, that I put in my 60, 70 hours a week and so that you have to too, has to give way to a more compassionate kind of approach for this happening. Again, it's only going to help everybody at the end of the day, but it's going to take time. We're getting there. I don't think I could have been having these conversations 5-7 years ago as across the board as I'm feeling it right now, but it's going to take time. It's going to take time.
Right. And the mindset has to shift. And I think that you're going to have to meet people where they are. Because, you know, saying to, let's say, trial lawyers like Bob and like me, be more compassionate, use mindfulness techniques. When you're in the throes, when you have your armor on, when you have your sword drawn, that is like using a slingshot in modern warfare. Right. There has to be a different message that meets folks where they are. And that's a segue to my next question. So if everything you want about legal education, your vision came to fruition, what would that look like for you? How would law students be educated differently? And how would they, I'm asking multiple questions, but I'll refine to one. How would they come out of their law school experience looking different, feeling different, knowing something different than they do right now?
Sure. I don't have significant issues with legal education writ large, right? There, you know, we could unpack and pick apart the Socratic method and how it affects certain individuals. And we could talk about individuals who are introverts, but very much want to practice in the law and some of the challenges that they have to overcome unique to them in that regard at the end of the day. And these are challenges and these are growth. And some of this is, again, is just professional development. We all have, you know, the issues that we have to overcome, personal, professional, and everything else. The more a student can graduate self-aware, both of their shortcomings and where their strengths are, and also, I mean, it sounds trite, but aware of the world around them and compassionate about it, right? I mean, every case, or virtually every case that a student studies in school has human beings involved. Every case does. And the more one can take that moment and say, this was about individuals at the end of the day, and it is about individuals at the end of the day, the more passion can come into the work. There's still work to be done. There's going to be a winner. There's going to be a loser. That's part of the, you know, the zero-sum game, the quid pro, whatever you want to call it. And that has to happen, but it can be done with compassion. And so I think the students, and again, and this is not inconsistent with students who are looking to, you know, grab that ring and go for the, you know, the law firm, the large law firms, you know, the big law and make lots of money. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not inconsistent at all. Those individuals are still going to be fighting for clients. They still have an opportunity to serve the community, whether it's pro bono or other work, but they need to, my ideal vision would be that every one of our students who graduates from every school has that awareness, the desire to help, to be compassionate while they're doing the work they're doing. You can be, and it's one of the catchphrases I know the firm has, you can be merciless at what you're doing, but you can have compassion at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive at the end of the day. And that's, I think that would be my, you know, my kind of overwhelming vision at the end.
So, David, let's land it with this question for you. If you could have all the students that you've advised and taught over the years say one thing about you, what would that be?
I was there for them when they needed me. I would say that I would like to believe that I've been here for my students as much as I can be. I'm not perfect. I've had challenges. I've had issues where students felt that I may have let them down. It's part of the process, and even part of learning for me. The fact that I've done it for so many years doesn't mean that I can't miss something. We have a large population. I work at one of the largest law schools in the country, and one of our challenges is to be proactive, as with any school, and not to be simply waiting for a situation and look to address it. We have issues, you know, these days we have issues around, you know, systemic racism that exists nationally, but issues can crop up at law schools. You need to be sensitive to it, constantly be a learner in that regard, be mindful that there may be spaces and challenges that you still need to focus upon. But I, you know, if my academic tombstone were going to be carved, I hope it would say he was there for me when I needed him.
Well said, and kind of echoes the themes of mentoring, both having mentors, mentoring others, which is a culture we have to continue to fertilize in the law.
Agreed.
For the issues that we've discussed. Thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I appreciate the two of you both having me and the podcast you've been doing and looking to create this space and continue to strengthen it. So I thank you both in turn.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Iron Advocate and that you take what you've learned and integrate it into your own personal practice. As always, we leave you with a minute of mindfulness. Breathe in, breathe out, and we'll see you next time.